From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Annie Seiler, whose debut novel is The Wisdom of Winter, published by Atmosphere Press. At various times, Annie Seiler has lived in a train car, studied at an Ivy League university, dumpster dived, traveled with governors' spouses, hand-milked goats, lost hope, kept secrets, and seen ghosts. Annie grew up in Connecticut, fled to San Francisco in her 20s, and touched down in Washington, D.C. in her 30s, before landing in Vermont. 2 decades later, she appears to have stopped running. The Wisdom of Winter is her debut novel. This is a note from Annie at the start of her book. I believe in the possibility of harmony. I believe in the power of dreaming. I believe the differences between us make the discovery of our similarities so very interesting. I believe I am accountable for my actions and words. I believe in our ability to change the world. Here's a little bit of information about the book. Insulated from societal mores by her glamorous mother and humble father, 6-year-old Beatrice, barefoot, in ratty overalls, tunes into animals, senses the unspoken, and thrives. But when tragedy penetrates their rural Vermont bubble, Beatrice is thrust into a world that tells her she has no place unless she hides her depth, pretties up, and falls in line. She complies. Years later in San Francisco, incongruities in Beatrice's life abound. What's real is hidden, what's false is celebrated. She numbs and sidesteps, and despite inner warnings, artfully outruns thoughts of her family, the girl she once was, and the woman she pretends to be. But when a cascade of events steers her back to her childhood home, a discovery in a run-down barn quiets her. In the still point, she sees her crossroads. Should she carry on the known path or step into uncertainty? Her future rests on her interpretation of change, anxiety and loss, or hope and renewal. She must decide who she is. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Annie Seiler. The book starts with the line, "She used to be still." And it made me think, I liked that opening, and it made me think about what makes for a good beginning. And I ask this sometimes of people, what makes for a good beginning to a novel in your opinion? And the natural second part of that is, what makes for a good end of a novel in your opinion? And we don't have to talk about how your novel ends, but just those two ideas, how a beginning and end can serve a reader's experience.
Well, I wrote this book in a very organic manner, and I wrote it in the early hours of the morning before my mind was really active, and it was dark out and my dog was still asleep, and I wrote it sitting on the floor in my dining room. I wanted to take away anything that felt intellectual and structured and pressured. So the beginning of this story, I think, really came from a place of wonder, a place of maybe a dreaming place, a place that isn't really sort of between realities kind of a place. Mm-hmm. And it allowed me to sort of capture her voice quickly too, because we meet in the womb and she's not fully formed yet. She's sort of this raw essence, this raw spirit. And I found that to be a way for me as an author to get to know her, and also a way to start the story that was unusual and organic. I wasn't thinking, how can I start this book in a great way? I really was sitting, you know, in almost darkness with my laptop and feeling this character, Beatrice. And it seemed appropriate to start before she got here.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. And it does start with her still in her mother's womb. And I think that's really cool that you were in a kind of cocooned, dark space, working in quiet. I like that. And then the next, I think it's the end of that chapter, there's the line, we both knew ours was a reunion, not a beginning. And I didn't particularly find it super obvious right from the start that she was in the womb. And I loved that gradual sort of gaining of understanding that this is what's happening. And I loved that line, we both knew ours was a reunion, not a beginning. And then the next chapter finds Beatrice lying still as her mother's silky voice floats up through the floorboards. And it was interesting to me that in the next chapter, there's still something of a remove. You know, we learn that they are very close. Beatrice loves her mother very much. Her mother's a wonderful character. But, you know, the first two moments that we meet them, there is this remove. The first one, she's in the womb, and the second one, she can sort of hear her mother a little bit kind of vaguely from another room singing. So that was really interesting to me, given the arc of their relationship and the sort of the ups and downs of mothers and daughters, you know, that this begins with both of those chapters at a bit of a remove.
Well, isn't that an interesting part for us as women, and maybe for just men and women, is that whole journey of separation from our mothers, women and our mothers, women and our parents. I mean, and certainly for me, it's in my life, there's that evolution of identity that starts out very much, who am I in my mother's eyes? How does my mother see me? How does my mother experience me when I'm a child? And then as a teenager, maybe you don't know me, but you do. And then the opportunity in adulthood for more of a mutual knowing, a mutual recognition that isn't as imbalanced parent-child, it's more peer-to-peer. But there's so much time there. It could be a lifetime, and we might never get to that place of sort of more of a peer relationship. But I mean, our mothers are so powerful.
Yes.
I love what you're saying. And I think that in some place I was aware of Beatrice's beginning separate and having to be separate and in different ways throughout her whole story in this book. She never fully relinquished herself to someone else's perception of her, never fully.
Mm-hmm. I liked Beatrice as a character, and I loved the fact that even in times when she is questioning herself and unhappy in her own skin, she also has this basic understanding that she's got a pretty good compass to follow. And she does that by herself, largely.
She does, and she's capable of denial, and she's very capable of denial. And it's something that it's a tool that she uses. But there's always a part of her that doesn't buy it. There's always a part of her that doesn't truly embrace whatever she's pretending she doesn't know. And I think that is what creates some of the of the push-pull in her and some of the interest in her, because I think and I know a lot of people who, you know, we go along a path and then something makes us pivot or makes us stop, and we have a moment where we say, like, is this really me? Mm-hmm. And you know, we can be avoiding something we know for a lifetime. We can drink over it or smoke over it or, you know, marry over it or have 10 children over it. I mean, there are many things we can do at those feelings of wanting to not look or not know or pretend we don't remember. Not that those are reasons why people do those things, but you know what I mean? That
sometimes,
or have 10 dogs or, you know, and I think I liked that she was someone who could never quite escape that her own litmus test of, am I being true? Is this really me? Or am I faking? Mm-hmm. Is there a truer me?
Yeah. I have a question about your scenes. Do you mind if I read a few things from the book?
No, go ahead.
Okay. You often begin a scene or a chapter in scene, mid-scene, and usually in those moments you begin in setting. So here are a few. Ginny and I sit alone on the rear steps looking out across the darkened lawn and distant barn. A faint golden glow clings to the edges of the sky while the ground lies drenched in shadows. Here's another one. The sky hangs low and gray. A biting wind whistles through the empty chicken coop and barrels across the crisp, glossy snowpack. Here's another one. My toes curl over the end board on Ginny's dock, a slatted finger that juts from the grassy shore about 15 feet into the glistening lake. And I remember once hearing a lecture about how beginning and setting is one of the best ways to ground your reader in the moment in time, because we are all sort of looking for place when we're trying to envision scene. So I just wonder if you're aware of that when you do it, and if that's something that you believe is the best way to begin, or if that just sort of also happens organically for you.
That definitely happens organically for me. I have not studied writing. I don't have an MFA. I really approach this from a very instinctual level. And in the writing of this book, I had an outline for the whole book that of course changed, but I had an outline. I had a sense in each chapter of what basically was going to happen and what the point of that chapter was. Mm-hmm. So when I would sit to write that chapter, I just had this very, you know, very high level understanding of what I was going to do and what the purpose was. But then when I got into the writing of it, it was like I was stepping into a room of a house. And the way I think as a writer was able to ground myself in that new chapter, that new room, was to observe it physically around me, whether that meant the character was outside or whether she was in bed or whether she was at the office. And that was really my way of getting comfortable with the chapter, with the story. And I don't know if that's common or uncommon or advised but it was just, you know, it was the way I did it. And there was so much of the writing of this book that I consciously didn't read books on plot, and I didn't read books on character development, and I didn't go down that road. I've written all my life, but personal creative writing has always been for myself. I haven't really done a lot of creative writing that I've shared. So the written word is familiar and comfortable, and I love it. I love the perfection of the word, and I love the feeling of collaboration when you're writing and you're not quite sure who you're collaborating with. But I didn't know what I was supposed to do to set up a chapter or how I was supposed to end a chapter. So I just threw all that out and found this way, and it was very visual for me. It required a visual component for me to set the stage and even have a sense of what the characters were wearing or how they were moving or how they were fidgeting or whatever. I was sort of seeing it. And that's what allowed me to write it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the wonderful thing about that is that you are your first reader. And so what works for you or what appeals to you will probably appeal to your readers, certainly the readers that gravitate toward your work and your style. I want to talk about your details. And I know you say you haven't studied this stuff, but I think having worked and having been a writer all your life, hopefully you have some ideas about this. So I have great respect for people who use detail well, but also know when to include detail and when not. And in your case, I feel that you do a really good job with this. Your scenes sort of come to life. They sort of grow in moments of important emotional resonance. Okay. So for example, when Beatrice is about to meet her newborn brother, she walks toward a room and she sees the nurse, and the nurse's blue scrubs are close enough for me to touch. So all of a sudden we see more about the nurse than if that sort of generic term nurse had been used. She's wearing blue scrubs, you know, and the fact that the word touch is used means that I can almost feel that fabric, you know, even though she doesn't reach out and touch her. I feel like you're really good with the sensory details. But knowing the color of the jacket of a random person on the street, you know, unless you're really trying to fill in the street for some important reason, I don't know that that's necessary. So you're really good at that. So I just thought we could talk a little bit about details. And when you're writing, are you often pulling out, okay, well, I don't need all of that here. This is not an important moment. Or again, what any thoughts you have on that?
Oh, I definitely, I overwrite for sure. I over describe. My first draft is full of dangling clause nonsense, you know, where I was trying to get at that precision, to get at what needed to be in that scene, but I didn't know yet. So I would sort of throw everything at the wall in the first draft and have far more descriptions than I ultimately would need or stick with. And having a good editor, it was an important part of the process for me, is someone who can say, this is too much, or this is repetitive, so I'm learning as a writer how to edit myself as I'm having these wonderful editors participate. But my first inclination is to, as I said, throw it all out, throw it all there, see it all, and then go back and identify what feels the most important, and then be willing to like throw out those other little pieces that at the time felt like they were magic, but really who called it? Someone called it, you have to be willing to kill your little darlings. I don't remember who said
it's
it.
It's a quote. But, I can't remember who said it, but it is a good one.
It's a good one. And that rings in my head. Sometimes I'll write something that I just think is absolutely brilliant and it does not fit and it probably isn't brilliant, but I do a lot of editing.
Yeah.
I do a lot of editing and that helps me to, it helps me to feel like nothing is like, I don't have to have any ancillary notes or any other sort of train of thought, that I can just throw it all on that first draft, knowing that I'll come back and have a chance to revisit it and re-experience it and kind of go, yeah, no, that was a great idea, but, it's not really necessary, I guess is the word. Is it necessary?
Right. I think that's really hard sometimes to do. I mean, there have been times where, you know, I've written something and I'm just like, this has got to go somewhere. And it's just such a skill to extract it, you know, pull it out, move it, you know, put it in another file and say you're going to use it someday, which mostly people don't, but it's always available.
That's what I'll do too, is like, I'll write it down somewhere else because I just can't kill it yet. But I just want to know that it's there if I ever use it. And of course, I probably won't. But.
I want to talk a little bit about your characters. I know from reading your bio that there are places in this book that intersect a little bit with your own experience in life. So I am curious if some of these characters were based on real people or if for the most part they would not be recognizable to people that you grew up near or around. So I'm curious about that. And I'm also curious about your development of characters and how you find the little quirks that make them special and unique people.
Well, there is a lot of memoir in this book, and almost all the characters are composites of aspects of people that I know and love, and fictional elements. So no one in the book is exactly anyone in my life. The dog Lobo and the draft horse Kate come the closest of all the characters in the book to being true to animals in my life. But I didn't want this to be a memoir. I didn't want to write the story of my family. I really wanted to write fiction. Mm-hmm. I wanted to feel the freedom of fiction. My first draft, the characters, I think, except for Beatrice, who came very naturally to me, the characters were a little more one-dimensional. And the editing process was critical for me to see where I could create some complexity and some mystery even in some of the characters, like particularly like Nicholas. Nicholas started out as pretty much you meet the guy, that's who he is, and he's kind of just that the whole way. And I've had a lot of my female friends say, God, I didn't like him at all. And I thought that's good though, because he represented something to push against. But he also by the time the story was published, he had evolved. There was a little bit more vulnerability to him. And he had started out invulnerable, sort of this guy you would absolutely recognize. So that really took those second and third passes for me to see that I was clinging to something familiar. And it was really, he would be a more interesting character. I had to give him a little more credit. I had to give some characters a little more credit, give them a little more depth, and have there be no one who is really like, oh, well, that person's good and that person's bad, or that person is on her side and that person is against her. Because in life I find that too. Like people, if I have a snap judgment, if I have a first impression, you know, it's often wrong. It's simplified. It's one aspect of a person, but it's easy to sort of build a narrative in one's head about who someone is based on that first experience. And I was aware of that as I was building out these characters, that I didn't want anyone to be just who they presented themselves to be when you first meet them or the first couple scenes you meet them. I really wanted everyone to have their own arc, even if it was just a slight change or the possibility of change or enormous change. That felt important to me.
Yeah. And I'm thinking about what you're saying, and I'm going to say that even Nicholas's ex-wife, who's really seen only in snapshots, plus a tiny bit of dialogue, but it's like, we see a snapshot, we make an opinion of her. somebody says something about her, we kind of adjust that opinion of her. She says something to Beatrice in a private moment, we kind of adjust that opinion of her. And then later we hear more about her, you know, and I love that. And she's a very small role, although she has maybe a large part to play in the arc of Beatrice's path. But anyway, yeah, she grew. She became three-dimensional as the story continued, so... I feel a little bit like I'm not talking about the story because I'm asking you a lot about your writing. So let's talk a little bit about the story, because I thought it was a wonderful story, and I, you know, there's no bridges exploding, you know, there's no, I mean, this is a story of people, real people, relationships, family, and the way that we learn and grow from our loved ones. So Beatrice is born into this seemingly perfect, ideal family with a loving mother who's beautiful and artistic, and then this loving father who's academic and works with his hands, and they live in this lovely farmhouse, you know. And as time goes by, we realize that maybe the lovely farmhouse from Beatrice's young eyes is more run down than we realized at first, But then, you know, just like with what I said about things becoming more three-dimensional as time goes on, we recognize what this family is and how it's a little bit different than we thought at first. And then she has a baby brother that's born into the family, and so things change and proceed. I loved Beatrice's character, and I loved just little things about her, the fact that she leaves one egg for the fox when she goes out to collect the eggs, and it's clear that the fox has been near the hen house. There are just little tiny things. So I do want to just talk a little bit about the storyline itself. Who was your hardest character, maybe, to write? We could start there.
My hardest character was Lily, her mother. Again, for this sort of the same reason as I said earlier, I started out with an idea of Lily as playing a very particular role in Beatrice's life. But as I wrote and got further into the story, I really second-guessed that whole approach that I'd had. And I realized that originally Lily was really not on her daughter's side. Originally, Lily was sort of something that Beatrice had to get around and prove herself to and disagree with, that the relationship was much more combative. And then at some point I realized, no, I want this mother to be as complex as she is and have going on what she has going on, but to be absolutely her daughter's champion. And that, I think, was a really, I don't know where that realization came from, but that surprise made me go back and really rewrite the first six chapters of the book when I had that understanding. And there's something about having a parent who sees you, really sees you, sees not only your surface self, but sees your sort of maybe your broken self or your uncertain self, is a very powerful thing. And I guess it really doesn't have to be a parent, but being a child and having any adult in your world see you, and you know they see you, especially if you have a bunch of siblings and some of them are taller or prettier or louder or more funny. But when someone sees you as a child, it's transformative, I think. And I wanted this child, I ultimately realized I wanted this girl who was living in this sort of unusual, unconventional way. And here in Vermont, it's maybe not as unconventional, but in the larger scheme of things, it's unconventional. You know, she's got a chicken coop and she's not groomed and she doesn't brush her hair. And to have this mother who could see her amidst her own drama, complexity, doubts, complicated marriage, et cetera, I think really anchored Beatrice and anchored, it made us care about what happens to that mother more.
Absolutely.
And I again, it was like I really saw where I was leaning towards sort of these one-dimensional stories, these linear stories, these readily identifiable relationships, and saying, wait a second, like, it's always messier than that. It's always more complex than that. You know, all the good stuff comes from that complexity and those, you know, realizing, looking back on a relationship you had and seeing it differently just because you're 20 years older or just because you're 50 years older, and seeing your part in it and seeing what you were bringing to the relationship and seeing it, just things you couldn't see before. And I think for Beatrice, that visibility in her mother's eye, that total acceptance, mm-hmm. was part of what allowed her to have the arc that she had in the story. She had something to return to in a way, because that had been planted with her mother.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The complexity you talk about is, I think, made richer by some subtlety. And this is just one little moment, but there's a moment where, I can't remember what her dad says. I'm not even remembering what scene this is, but her dad says something, and Beatrice reflects, even Mom laughed at that. And although I had picked up on a little tension between her parents that was sort of like pre-existing in this whole situation, that moment was like, oh, okay, I'm right. There's tension there. You know, even Mom laughed at that, and Mom doesn't usually laugh at Dad's jokes is sort of the next thing that we can take from that. So that was, you know, I like subtlety. I hate it when something is just like thrown in my face, and the complexity, I think, is hard. I mean, I think writing about relationships is harder than bridges blowing up, you know, definitely harder.
Well, it's definitely a different audience. You know, I mean, it's definitely, I mean, someone who's drawn to the bridges blowing up will probably have a hard time with this book. And people who are tired of bridges blowing up will probably adore this book, you know? I mean,
exactly.
And I've loved the bridges blowing up stories, and I go through phases where I don't want a single bridge to blow up. I just want to be on the interior of people's lives and be moving in a story, not just like, who is this person? I want there to be action. I want there to be movement. I want to be following something. But I think I just get tired of, especially with what's happening in the world. I was sort of really drawn to writing a story that was, that wasn't perilous, that wasn't gritty.
The other thing I loved about this book is there are fewer of these books than there used to be. There really are. And I want to talk about your publishing journey. I'm wondering if you found that it's harder to get a book like this published than it used to be. I read this book and I was thinking of Ann Tyler. You know, I mean, I feel like there used to be a lot more books out there that had the same audience that Ann Tyler had, right? So I'm just curious. Well, I am curious. What was your publishing journey like?
It was perilous.
Yeah.
I had it in my mind that I wanted to go the traditional route, that I had to be the traditional route, so I spent 9 months, crafting the perfect and possibly perfect query letter, which of course was never perfect, and pitching to agents and being on publishers' marketplace and looking at what was selling and all these pithy, clever, just, you know, one sentence descriptions of books, you know, Jaws meets Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And I just, all of it felt like a foreign world. But I really wanted to go that route. I just had it in my mind that was really the only doorway to go through. And after about 9 months of it and really getting nowhere, not even getting responses, not getting even thank you for your, I mean, nothing. I got a couple of, that's not true. Maybe one agent emailed me and said, I'm just too busy. I love the idea, but I'm too busy. And all the rest really were just either form auto rejections or silence. Mm-hmm. And it was a really difficult time. It was a really difficult time to be in silence with it. It was really treacherous. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't really part of a community of writers. I didn't have a support system around it. The woman who had done the original manuscript evaluation was sort of writing co-pilot with me in a way that she maybe didn't even understand how important it was. Cause I would sort of, she would say to me, how's it going? I'd be like, you know, nothing, just crickets. And she'd be like, keep going. And then eventually I picked the phone and I called her, and she lives in DC. And I said, I don't know if I can do this anymore. And she said, well, maybe it's time to consider a hybrid publishing model. And I was like, okay, well, what is that? And she explained what it was. And she said, you know, readers ultimately don't really care who published your book, and they don't really care what the cost structure of that book was. They really just want a good story. And that was the best thing she could have said to me. So about a week later, she said, a colleague of mine has just published with Atmosphere Press, and she's a great writer and she's speaking really highly of them. Why don't you, you know, submit your manuscript to them? So I submitted my manuscript, I think the following week, to Atmosphere Press, and I got a response within, you know, 72 hours, and the acquisition editor said, yeah, we'd love to publish this book. So, and it was really easy at that point. Not easy. It was easy to let go of that old story of, if it has to be this way, but the door was shut. Like, I was ready to let go of a door being shut. I was ready to let go of that feeling of being stuck in place, you know, wheels turning, story ready in so many ways, me ready for whatever came next, ready for whatever was asked of me, ready for tough editors, ready for whatever was next, and stuck in place. It was brutal.
Yeah, it was absolutely brutal. And I'm so sorry that happened to you, although I'm glad you found your path. And I think it's so good for people who are listening right now, many of whom are writers, to hear that story, because that is a sadly common story.
And it can keep us from writing. It can keep us, I mean, we can put our manuscripts under beds and walk away. Mm-hmm. And that there are other doors. And my experience with this particular publisher has been really positive. And particularly the developmental editor I worked with, Asada Radcliffe, was incredible. I mean, she pinpointed gaps in this story that I had never seen. My original manuscript evaluator had never seen. And as hard as it was at that stage to be hearing you have plot gaps, she was absolutely right. And the book is so much better as a result of her rigorous evaluation. So I think maybe even having a really good editor or really good editors might even be more valuable to me as an author than having the big name publisher, although I'd accept that too. But at this stage, I think having a great editor is really what was key for me.
Wonderful. I want to ask you, I have the suspicion that maybe this also happened organically, but this was so well done. And whether it was on purpose or not, I just want to share my takeaway with you, okay? So I think sometimes moments of high emotion are really hard to present, and moments of tragedy are really hard to present. And I am always interested to see how an author leads us into a tragedy, a moment of terror, or other high emotion. So a tragedy happens midway through your book. I won't go into that, what it is, but I just want to talk about leading readers toward tragedy. So you use the senses to lead us in, and I'm curious if you knew you were doing this. It's so incredible. So two characters are holding hands, and we have touch. Citronella candles are burning on a table, and we can infer smell. The characters are facing woods, cliffs, and a lake, so we get to see what they're seeing. A character takes a bite of barbecued rib, so we have the taste. And then finally, they hear a siren. I mean, to me, that was like, oh my gosh. That is so awesome. Did you know you were doing that?
Yes and no. No, in that I wasn't imagining every sense, but yes, in that I know when I read about when an author captures sense well, I am so aware of it. I am so aware of that whole experience that when it's done. So it's in the back of my mind. Certainly, it's something that I value. And in my approach to writing, sitting there looking at the quote unquote room, it's how I'm grounding myself in that scene, taste, sight, smell, sound. But that's sort of a background. It's sort of in the background. Okay. It's not quite as intellectual, but it's definitely there. And I'm glad you liked that. I loved that scene, and that character is a character. The male character in that scene is based on someone that I knew very well when I was young. His brothers were really hard on him. His brothers were really hard on him. And he was a phenomenal, he passed away. He died young, and his brothers were really hard on him. And he could hold this extraordinary strength in the midst of all kinds of onslaughts. You know, he was small. He wasn't a big guy. His brothers were big, and they were loud, He was gentle, and he was gentle and strong. He was gentle and strong. He had this wonderful ability to hold both. He was kind, and he was gentle, and he was strong in this way that is so, it gives me goosebumps talking about him. I guess I really, I when I meet men like that, or I date men like that, my brother is my real brother in real life is very much like that. He's a very strong guy, and he's also gentle and kind and compassionate. And that to me just makes for like a Superman.
Yeah. I do like to always ask people what they've been reading lately that they might recommend to people, because my listeners are all readers. So do you have any one or two titles that you would recommend?
Well, I've been on a mystery genre kick lately. Reading.
I love mysteries.
I've been reading a lot of Ellie Griffith's work, going through her her series. I've been reading Cynthia Herod Eagles, who I don't even know that she's, I think she wrote 20 years ago. I'm not even sure. But she has a character, Detective Bill Slider, who is just quirky and wonderful. And Deborah Crombie, I like very much. And I'll just be in a genre for a while, and then I'll want something completely different and move on to another one.
That's great. I haven't read those people, and I love mysteries too, so I'm glad to hear that. Are you writing anything now, or are you taking a break? What are you working on?
I am working on book promotion.
Yeah.
I am in the thick of, I have a full-time job, so book promotion is my additional part-time job. And I really decided that it's definitely another book in me, and many books in me. But I want to spend the next year getting this book out into the world. And that in and of itself is its own journey. And it's a new mystery for me. What's it going to ask of me? How am I going to have to stretch? I'm an introvert, so it's all way outside my comfort zone, but I'm surprised at how much I'm enjoying it. But I really want to get this book out. And if I can attract an agent, that would be great. If I can, translate the book into Spanish, that would be great. If I can just, get a book announcement in a newspaper, that'd be great. So I'm trying to just move all those little pieces. And at some point I will begin to allow the next book to kind of come through. It's out there. It's orbiting like a planet. It's definitely there. And whether it's a continuation of more of Beatrice's adventures or something completely different, I don't know yet. But I've sort of said, like, I'm not quite ready. Let's see what we can do with this book first.
So I would love to know if you have advice for people. Well, I will say again, so having read the bio on your website, I had the sense that some of this story comes from your own life. And I do wonder if you have advice for writers who might like to write fiction rather than memoir and want to bring some of their own personal life experience into their fiction.
My advice would be to consider from the get-go how your family members and friends and people who are in any way informing your plot or your characters, how they might experience your storytelling. And I think that there's so many ways to take truth or experience and real people and evolve them into fictional characters in a way that those people feel comfortable. And I think that's important. I'm very close to my family. I adore my family, and we've all been through a lot together. And I'm at a place where I don't want to hurt any of them in any way. So that was really a big part of me thinking, okay, how can I take some of these little nuggets and evolve them into fiction? And in the scenes that I knew my family would either recognize specifically what happened or the themes they would recognize, I was just cognizant of telling those pieces in a way that that was really about what was happening to the main character, as opposed to what was happening more to the mother, or happening to the father, or happening to Helen, or happening. It was really driven by this main character's experience. That was always where the focus was. But I, for me, I, as a debut novelist, drawing on memoir was a huge, huge resource for me. And in some ways, maybe I didn't feel the need to go to those books about plot and character development as much because I had this life experience that was informing that storytelling. And that's not to say I don't have a lot to learn, because I'm continually learning, and I'm sure that I'll get better at plot. I'll get better at all of this. But I think it's a great way for a new author to go to look at what they know, what they've experienced, and what they believe as a basis for their storytelling.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I want to mention again, the name of the book is The Wisdom of Winter by Annie Seiler, who's been my guest today, published by Atmosphere Press. And Annie, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Shayla. It's a real pleasure. And I want to say congratulations on your 15 years of hosting this podcast. It's quite an accomplishment.
Thank you very much. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV, LP, Burlington. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Vermont author Annie Seiler. You can learn more about her work at annieseiler.com, and that's spelled S-E-Y-L-E-R. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Annie Seiler. Identify a moment from your childhood that shaped you somehow, and write it out as a scene, but with a different ending or outcome than the way you lived it. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. I've said this before, but just to reiterate, in March, Write the Book will come to an end after 15 years on the air. Even though that's true, I'd still love to hear what you think and how you came to the show and what your experience was through the years. So please share your thoughts by email. You can get in touch at writethebook@gmail.com. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. In the meantime, I'll put some music on. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.